Before we dive into today's discussion, we have a special resource just for you, a free ebook called Does It Make Sense to Believe in God? In today's world where faith is often labelled as outdated or irrational, this ebook takes a fresh look at the evidence for God. It features reflections from years of engaging with some of the world's leading atheists, like Richard Dawkins, and reveals why, after hearing every conceivable argument, our confidence in God's existence is stronger than ever. Download Does It Make Sense to Believe in God today for free at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, let's get started with today's show.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really thrilled to say that we've got a guest on the show again, which is Dr. Francis Collins. How are you, Francis?
I am just fine. Nice to see both of you.
Likewise. We're really excited to have you on the show, Francis. I might go far to say, no disrespect to our previous guest, possibly the most well-known person to appear on Matters of Life and Death to date. Possibly. We'll get into that later, maybe. For those of you who haven't come across you before, Francis, would you mind briefly introducing yourself?
I'd be happy to. So I'm a physician. My area of expertise as far as my own research is genetics. I served as the leader of the Human Genome Project, which read out the first script of human biology, the human genome. And then I served under three presidents in the United States as the director of the National Institutes of Health, which is the largest supporter of biomedical research in the world. I'm a Christian, but I became a Christian in my 20s, not having grown up with any particular faith and traveling through atheism before I got to the point of recognizing that what I really needed was to understand faith, and I became a follower of Jesus. And I've never found a conflict between my faith and what I know as a rigorous scientist, and had the chance to write about that in a book called The Language of God almost 20 years ago, and to start a foundation called BioLogos, which is a meeting place for a lot of people who are interested in those conversations about rigorous science and Bible-based Christian faith. I'm currently a researcher at the National Institutes of Health studying diabetes and a rare form of premature aging called progeria, and working with the White House in the U.S. to try to eliminate a terrible disease called hepatitis C, for which we have a cure, but the cure is currently not getting to all the people who need it. And I wrote a book that came out just very recently called The Road to Wisdom, which is about my deep concern about how we become so polarized in our society. And we need to recognize we've lost some anchors that are pretty important in the areas of truth and science and faith and trust. And we need to try to figure out how to recover those so that we can travel successfully down that road to wisdom, to a future that encourages human flourishing instead of so much animosity.
Francis, yes, it's fascinating to meet you in this way. I've known your name very well for many decades, and particularly I'm interested in the role that you've played as a Christian and as a scientist and a physician, but also in a very contested and sometimes hostile political environment, and how you've at a lesser level I've had sometimes similar experience here in the UK, and wondered how you've found it trying to navigate that role.
It has been challenging at times, but I would say for the most part, I feel incredibly privileged to be given an opportunity to do things I never would have dreamed were going to be part of my life's journey. To be able to try to stand at the helm of something like the NIH and steer it in interesting directions that were going to make discoveries that might actually alleviate human suffering. That seemed like a pretty amazing thing to wake up in the morning and realize that's my calling. Certainly, there were plenty of times where not everybody agreed with that directionality or decisions that I made, and that sort of came with the territory. If it was on a purely scientific basis, I welcome that because that's actually the way in which we have vigorous discussions and sometimes change opinions. If it was an attack on my faith, which also happened at times, sometimes that was harder to absorb, especially if it came from another Christian who in many instances have been the ones writing the meanest emails to me, which is sort of a sad statement about the way in which both society in general and our Christian communities have become comfortable, it seems, expressing a lot of animosity that probably is not what we are called to be. Certainly don't fit very well with the Sermon on the Mount.
So certainly there's one of the fascinating things, isn't it, that that it sometimes seems that it's Christians who are often most hostile to people like yourself in a prominent position, and even seem most susceptible to various kinds of disinformation. I mean, why do you think that is? What is there about? Is it the culture? Is it other things to do with the nature of the Christian faith that makes people vulnerable in this way?
I think there's a long history we have to recognize here of perceived tensions between science and faith. Certainly in the U.S., that has been particularly prominent on the basis of what are your views about origins? And does what science is teaching us about the age of the universe, namely 13.6 billion years, does that conflict with Genesis 1 and 2 in the way in which they describe origins? For me, as a person who takes the Bible very seriously, but also looks at the data, wanting to understand just how confident one can be in it, there is no way that I can arrive at a young earth perspective based on what the science says. But I'm reassured that when I look at Genesis 1 and 2 and read what Augustine had to say about it in 400 AD, when there was no need to apologize for his views, he specifically warned us not to start treating that particular book of the Bible as a historical scientific description of origins. It was much more important than that. And when you read a book like John Walton's book, The Lost World of Genesis 1, you can really begin to appreciate what this must have meant to its first readers. So I've not found that conflict in my own life to be distressing. It's been illuminating to dig into it and think about it. But it still lingers there as a source, I think, of unease on the part of many conservative Christians. And so when something comes along that sounds like a scientific judgment that is very significant for what they need to do with their lives, there may be a bit of initial skepticism, like, okay, who are these people? There's an assumption that most scientists are atheists, which is not true. There's certainly an assumption, if you're not a scientist, that maybe these folks are a little bit of the elitist class. And you put that all together and put it in a circumstance like COVID, where there's a lot of fear about what's happening, about your family and your own life. And it's a bad mix. And good, honorable people who are worshiping God in the pew on Sunday morning, barraged over the course of the coming week with hours and hours of information from social media and cable news that is full of misinformation, sometimes intentional disinformation, and also a lot of anger. They get pushed into a space of starting to question whether anything can be trusted if it's not from their own small bubble of people who share their views. And that's kind of what's happened. And these are still wonderful people who are trying to live their lives, take care of their families, but our Christian spiritual formation maybe has shown not to be as strong as it might be. And people have found themselves behaving in ways that if they looked carefully at the foundations of their faith, particularly the words of Jesus, would have to say, ooh, that's probably not who I'm supposed to be. But it's almost been normalized, that kind of angry outburst. That's not who we are.
I was really struck when reading a bit of your book, Francis, when you quote a story about a pastor in a church somewhere in America who had kind of noticed that a lot of his congregation were kind of getting kind of curdled in this grievance culture. They were angry. And so he was preaching through the Beatitudes and trying to kind of bring them back to the way of Jesus. And at the end of one Sunday service, a couple stopped him on the way out and said, "Do you know, Pastor, we can't, you know, that might have been fine for Jesus to turn the other cheek and love your enemies, but that's not going to cut it today when we're fighting against woke liberals and the globalist establishment," you know.
Exactly. And you just, there is this apocalyptic sense that people have that we're in an absolute war against those other forces. And so all of those gentle rules that might have been fine for Jesus, they don't apply anymore. This sense of catastrophism that seems to have become very much part of the mindset of many conservative Christians, which is really not warranted. Religion is not under any threat at all in the United States. It's probably been, if anything, more free to express itself than in a long time. But that's not the way it feels to a lot of people in the church.
I mean, looking across the pond, it's sometimes quite hard for us as Europeans to really get our heads around some of this. And I just wonder whether historically part of it is a kind of anti-intellectualism of a large group of the sort of fundamentalist Christian groups. Mm. And then coupled with this apocalyptic millenarianism, isn't it, of... Which seems to be a very recurrent strand in American Christianity.
Yeah, I think some of that is also true. It's not that many years ago that Mark Knoll wrote that rather famous book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, the first sentence of which was, "The scandal of the evangelical mind is that there's not much of an evangelical mind," which is a terrible indictment. And he wrote it as a love letter to somebody who himself is part of that and felt like a wounded lover. I don't think things have gotten a whole lot better since then. My most important spiritual mentor to whom my current book is dedicated, Tim Keller, is one of the last things he did before his death of pancreatic cancer, wrote this 80-page really call to action called "The Decline and Renewal of the Evangelical Church." And one of the many recommendations he made was a renewal of the Christian mind, the Christian Mind Project, he called it. Mm. We've got to do something to try to elevate the interest and the expertise of Christians in intellectual activities, or it'll be too easy to be continually whipsawed by the latest barrage of information that sounds plausible, but for which many Christians are not well armed to assess in a critical way.
Could you share a little bit about about your relationship with Tim Keller? Because he was very pivotal in you deciding to write the book, wasn't he? Because he was doing his treatment for pancreatic cancer at an NIH hospital, is that right?
He was indeed. He became my close friend 15 years ago when I was thinking about trying to start this foundation that would bring people together to talk about rigorous science and Christian faith. That wasn't all that popular in some circles, and Tim was willing to be very public in his support of that, and was one of the reasons we were able to convene a series of meetings in New York City, because he acted as the host. Some of those early meetings, we brought evangelical leaders to talk about how science and faith could get along. And some of them said, "I'm going to come, but you can't tell anybody I was there," because it made them that uneasy. That doesn't happen anymore, I'm glad to say. But Tim was willing to step out there. He didn't agree with everything that the scientists were putting forward. He and I had this long-standing discussion about Adam and Eve that never really quite got resolved. But what a deep, wonderful thinker he was, and what an incredible encourager of people of faith to not settle for some superficial understanding. So I read lots of his books, and I still listen to lots of his seminars, his sermons, because they're on my laptop. And I did get to spend a lot of time with him in his last 2 years as he was battling stage 4 pancreatic cancer and came to NIH to undergo a very experimental, fairly radical immunotherapy protocol, which was indeed quite aggressive and made him quite sick. But he won himself a whole nother year as a result of that, with a really dramatic response, which unfortunately was not permanent. So I had many afternoons in his hospital room, which is right there on the NIH campus. So it was 5 minutes walk from my lab, talking about everything. He didn't want to talk about cancer. He wanted to talk about Jesus, and he wanted to talk about the state of the church. And when I expressed my deep concern about what's happened with our society becoming so polarized, and maybe there was even something I could do by writing about it, he was relentless in insisting that I absolutely had to do that, because I had many misgivings. Maybe I still do, but he would not let up. He said, if you can affect two people, then it's worth it. Maybe even one. You have to do it. You have to write this book.
Do you sometimes look around the state of the church in the US in particular and wonder, where are the next Tim Kellers? Who are those pastors who have that kind of incredible thoughtfulness and kind of rigor to their thinking, and yet are also, you know, seen by all as kind of biblically orthodox and yet have a kind of credibility in the outside world beyond the church walls as well? I don't know about you, but I don't see very many figures like that at the moment.
I think they're potential figures like that. I think they've been intimidated by the risks of creating schisms in their own communities if they spoke out too strongly, because people are so tense about so many issues. I was happy to see a recent statement signed by hundreds of young and middle career pastors, sort of a recommission, recommitting of themselves to the gospel as evangelicals. And the statement, which goes through several points, is basically a complete repudiation of the way in which politics has overtaken many of the conversations in the Christian church, and particularly right-wing politics, which has also kind of become a substitute in many church communities for their own biblical foundations, which is a truly unfortunate and dangerous situation. And they're calling that out and saying, we are not going to take part in that.
We're conscious of that coming across the pond, is this a right-wing nationalistic take on the Christian faith, which seems intellectually strong and assertive, but so easily seems to align to a particular political agenda. It's quite troubling sometimes to see this alignment between an intellectually credible defense of the faith associated with a very particular political direction.
It is, and I think there's plenty of commentaries out there that can tell you sort of the origins of this. This book by Tim Alberta called The Kingdom and the Power and the Glory, which sort of outlines over the course of a decade or more how the evangelical Christian community has become so overtaken by this desire for political power, which has been a completely negative contamination of what should have been the principles of the faith.
I still find that very surprising, because of course the roots of fundamentalist Christianity was completely the opposite, wasn't it? You didn't allow yourself to be contaminated by the world. The important thing was to withdraw, and that, you know, your society was going, you know, astray. That was what you'd expect, but we remain the faithful few, and we sang the songs of Zion and so on. So where did this political activism, it seems completely different from the root, from its roots?
It does indeed. And yet there's plenty of senior evangelical leaders in the US who I would think would know better. They actually do know something about what the Bible says, but have been carried away by this opportunity to sort of grab onto the levers of power. And I think a lot of it comes back to this catastrophism, this sense of being under what might be an existential attack on faith. They realize they've lost some status with the rise of people who don't have any particular religious interest, the so-called nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, in the U.S., which is a profound and rapid change. range 20 years ago, that was 7%. Now it's 30% of Americans. The church is very upset and worried about that, but I'm sorry, they've kind of contributed to it by the way in which they have portrayed themselves as political organizations, not places that you would go to and feel comfortable about admitting, you know, your own need for nurture and encouragement and wanting to be part of something that's bigger than yourself or some political campaign. So, yeah, I think that's part of perhaps the explanation, this feeling up against the wall. So we therefore have to put up a defense, like that couple talking to the pastor after the service. We're at war. It's not like the first century anymore. Well, go back to the first century and imagine what that was like.
And that's the remarkable thing, isn't it? You know, you know, people like Paul writing to the Romans saying that, you know, you've got to respect the governing authorities and live in peace and quiet. And this is living under a kind of tyrannical Roman emperor who called himself a god and turned Christians into human torches. You know, there really was an existential threat right there for the early church. And yet they were called back to this radical way of Jesus, which kind of repudiates that kind of assertive, aggressive, self-defensive posture.
Absolutely. Well said.
We're excited to announce the launch of a brand new podcast from Premier Insight called The Bible Explored with Rico Tice, featuring Rico Tice, a renowned British preacher and apologist. The Bible Explored with Rico Tice offers practical guidance for living out the eternal truth of God's word in everyday life. It will inspire and equip you to boldly share the gospel, even in life's toughest situations. To continue creating content and resources like this, we rely on the generosity of listeners like you. Your support is vital to keep Premier Insight strong and ensure programs like The Bible Explored with Rico Tice can reach more people to equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I guess it's one thing, I was, you know, reflecting on reading your work, Francis. It's one thing for evangelicals to kind of fall out with scientists over something like evolution, which is important, but, you know, not life shattering, however, whatever happened. But when it came to COVID, not believing the science or believing that you and scientists in the administration were somehow part of some kind of wicked liberal elite cabal trying to poison them actually led to hundreds of thousands of avoidable deaths because so many Americans didn't get vaccinated.
That's right. That is the most serious, heartbreaking part of this whole COVID experience, that God blessed the effort and a lot of prayer went into it and a lot of great science went into it to develop vaccines in 11 months that were 95% effective against that original virus with very little in the way of side effects. That was a spectacular result. I think history will say that was maybe the most significant scientific achievement ever when it comes to a direct application to humanity. And yet, in what is supposed to be an advanced technological society called the United States of America, more than 50 million people said, no, thank you. I don't want that vaccine because I heard it might not be safe. And maybe it's actually something that's been hidden. It's got chips in the syringe. It maybe will make me sterile. It makes me magnetic. That was a big one. I know. And people were taken in by that. And even for people of faith, there was a pretty strong perspective that was put forward. You don't want to do this. This is the mark of the beast.
Yeah. We had that certainly here in the UK as well. And we did, in fact, the origins of this podcast, it started in the COVID
era. That's right.
And they were some of our first episodes. We're talking about
should Christians take the vaccine? And you spent quite a lot of time, didn't you, Dad, trying to offer a kind of evangelical science medical based approach to some of these queries, because a lot of Christians had, you know, are they made with aborted fetuses cells? And, you know, these were serious questions, not from like weird wacko cranks, but that they were seriously worried. All the people that they trusted in the Christian world had told them to be worried about whether they should or shouldn't take the jab.
Yeah, no, it was a definite issue. And I think a lot of it was coming across from the States, inevitably because of social media and the internet and so on. At the time, there was a lot of concern and a deep suspicion, as you say. Well, I mean, again, one of the curious things I remember at the time sort of pointing this out was that, you know, when it came to the latest cancer treatment and so on, evangelical Christians were absolutely, I really want to have the latest, you know, whatever the scientists have come up with, I really want to have that, you know, and yet here we have a protective vaccine, which has gone through exactly the same kind of safety and efficacy testing and so on. And all of a sudden, no, I can't. Yes. You know, this is extraordinary doublethink about science and technology, but they're nonetheless very powerful. And there's something about vaccination, isn't there, of taking this foreign substance into my body, you know, which has always been, you know, because I've had endless discussions in a previous era with parents about the MMR immunization and all these concerns about pertussis, whooping cough vaccination and so on. So there's always been a frisson about vaccination, but then for some reason this was on steroids when it came to COVID.
Yeah, I think that was an undercurrent, and I thought, well, there's going to be a small subset of the community that has been suspicious before about vaccines, and they'll be the hardest one to convince. But, you know, we'll have the data, and even a lot of those people will go, oh yeah, okay, I really don't want to die of this terrible disease. But instead, it went the other way. That small subset became a large subset. And again, it reflected this overall sense of suspicion, skepticism, cynicism, doubts that scientists were really on the case in a way that they could trust. Are things being hidden? Is this all a way for pharmaceutical companies to make even more money than they already are? And all of those things just overwhelmed people who weren't maybe in a good position to assess the scientific data. We're counting on others who proposed to be experts to do so. And if you looked at cable news, that's not what you got. And if you looked at social media, you got the opposite of that. And sad to say, in the U.S., a fair number of politicians took advantage of that uncertainty to join with the skeptics and further do harm to people's ability to make a wise decision.
So the issue of trust is absolutely central, isn't it? And yes. It has, I mean, these kind of issues, they do focus a very bright spotlight on who you trust and why.
Yes.
And it is fascinating to me that, you know, in terms of the words truth and trust, are very closely related, you know, and ultimately truth is what a person you trust tells you. So truth cannot be reduced to a purely mathematical or abstract philosophical concept. It's ultimately about a relationship of trust. And so it does raise the question, doesn't it? Who is trustworthy? And historically, I think doctors, physicians, and scientists were regarded as trustworthy, but increasingly that is no longer the case for many, many people.
Yeah, trust has deteriorated across the board. The Gallup polling organization every year does an assessment in the U.S. of trust in various institutions. And if you look at those curves over the last 15 or 20 years, and particularly in the last 4 or 5, it has been a steady, universal downward slide. The only organizations that Americans have more than 50% of them saying they trust are small businesses, because those are the people at the corner store that you know. And the military, although the military has been also losing ground. Everything else is like in the untrusted category, including science and medicine and certainly political organizations. And some of that is earned distrust. The fact that, you know, in the United States, the trust of the U.S. Congress is, I think, at 8%. That's somewhat earned by how dysfunctional that institution has become, which is heartbreaking to see. I mean, those are our representatives. And if they're not trustworthy, it must be our fault that we've elected people who aren't actually representing what we want. But somehow we keep reelecting them. But science, I think, has also suffered in along the same way. Maybe a little bit of that is earned distrust. I would agree that some of the communication about science during COVID was not optimum. And I was part of some of the times where we were putting across CDC recommendations that ultimately had to be revised. And we didn't explain to people ahead of time that this was the best we could do at that point and it might change. And so they began to doubt whether we knew what we were talking about. But much of the science distrust is just manufactured as part of this overall cynicism about everything. And it's particularly happening from people of faith for reasons we talked about with this long history of having some tensions there.
I mean, it's striking to me that America was in quite a unique position in that they had someone like you who could have had the trust of both the science world with this long career of credibility, and yet you're also an outspoken evangelical who could speak to the Christians, and you think that you could be this kind of unique spokesperson saying, look, take it from me, I'm Dr. Francis Collins, I'm a follower of Jesus, these vaccines are safe and are not going to have the mark of the beast. But it didn't seem to work out like that, did it?
I tried, Tim. I did a podcast with Rick Warren and Franklin Graham and Walter Kim and Curtis Chang and Tim Keller and Tom Wright. And did it change anybody's mind? I don't know.
In fact, I think what happens is you get attacked from both sides, don't you? Which has also been my experience. I sometimes think when you're being attacked from both sides, well, you're probably getting it about right, aren't you? You're getting it in the neck from your fellow Christians and also your secular colleagues.
In there, yeah.
I wonder if we can move the conversation on slightly, Francis, but in the remaining of our time, to talk about some of the other issues that have come up in this podcast recently. We've been talking quite a bit about genetics, actually, and about, we mentioned in a previous episode, the kind of rise of what's sometimes called liberal eugenics, the idea of, you know, selecting via at the kind of embryo level your children for supposed preferable traits that we can now determine from kind of genetic testing. And there was even a kind of minor scandal you may have seen of a US startup called Heliospect that turned out had been offering parents kind of privately the chance to supposedly select the most high IQ embryos during IVF treatment. And I just wondered, what's your response to people who think that this is a good idea, that we can somehow improve humanity by using our powerful new genetic technology, as someone who was, you know, so involved in mapping the human genome all those years ago?
It is wrong in so many ways. So, first of all, scientifically, the things that people might think they want to select for are enormously complex kinds of genetic contributions. People are studying IQ, and yes, there are genetic factors that play out in whatever it is that we measure in IQ, although recognize that has all kinds of cultural contributions that need to be considered. But the idea that you could, with what we know about the hundreds of places in the human genome, where there might be a tiny effect one way or the other of whether you had a T or a C in that space, that you could use that in a clinical circumstance by sorting embryos and getting the best one. Sorry, scientifically, this is totally fanciful. The best you might be able to do is statistically bump up the IQ by 1 or 2 points. And parents who decide to take advantage of that might decide, okay, we've done our part now. We've done the perfect selection of the embryo. Everything is going to be fine. They need to remember that most of what matters there is what happens after birth with that child's education. And so I often imagine a hypothetical couple of that sort who's so proud of what they've done with genetics, but forget that just because they thought they'd optimized for athletic performance and intelligence and musical ability doesn't mean they won't have a sullen 16-year-old playing heavy metal music in his room and smoking pot all day because they forgot they had to be parents.
Yeah. There's also that famous, probably apocryphal story of Einstein and Marilyn Monroe. Do you remember where someone says, it's Marilyn Monroe who says to Einstein, look, why don't we have a baby, you know, with my looks and your brains? You know, they can't possibly go wrong. And he says, yes, but Marilyn, what about if we had your brains and my looks?
Yeah. Short men of traits, you can't be
social. And what would you say, Francis, to Christians who are kind of excited at the prospect of using genetic tools and genetic technology to say, you know, why wouldn't we want to do this? We could, you know, a lot of your early career was about identifying the genes that cause horrible conditions like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's with the hope that we could develop treatments. Isn't embryo selection so that we can kind of fine tune and improve the genome and the DNA of our children the next step on from that about trying to, you know, have the healthiest, happiest children possible?
No, it is not the next step. I think you got to make a really clear distinction between illnesses that are really quite serious, caused by particular genetic misspellings that have profound impact on the basis of a single gene, which you therefore have the ability to be able to measure and make a pretty good prediction about what's going to happen, like Huntington's disease or cystic fibrosis, or a disease that my lab works on called progeria, where these kids age at 7 times the normal rate because of one C that got mutated to a T in the genome in a vulnerable place. And we're working very hard on trying to come up with a way to help those kids by using gene editing to fix that mutation in a living child, using the CRISPR magic of delivering that kind of gene editor. It's sort of like find and replace in the word processor, except in this case, the word is the genome. I'm totally ready to defend that for a serious illness that has major effects on the ability of that individual to survive. But to imagine that somehow it's just a small step into something like intelligence or physical attractiveness or athletic ability or musical talent is just flying in the face of everything we have learned about the science. It's totally a different picture. And let me say, I also am very worried about what I see as a weakening of resistance to the idea of applying gene editing to human embryos. That, of course, was done once, maybe others that we don't know about. Once we do know about by the Chinese scientist in 2019, who, without permission of an appropriate sort or what anybody would have considered informed consent of the parents, edited the embryos of 2 little girls, supposedly to make them more resistant to HIV. The scientific argument there was extremely flimsy. The evidence that it worked and didn't cause all kinds of other off-target effects, we'll probably never know. This was a rogue experiment that never should have happened. And it was roundly decried at the time, and the guy went to jail for a while. But now in ethical conversations, I'm hearing some weakening of the argument against this. Like, well, you know, we're getting better at this. We're pretty sure we know what we're doing. Why not? Well, okay, here's where me as a person of faith has a big answer to why not. It's called, we are fearfully and wonderfully made by God. We are not in the space, I think, of jumping in to try to become the fearfully and wonderfully makers of an entirely new species. That's just not what we are here to do.
So for you, even if we could perfect CRISPR and we could go in with ultimate precision to play around and re-edit the genome in the future, even if we knew somehow that we wouldn't create any kind of harmful side effects and affect the germline, all these other ethical considerations, that would still for you be kind of on theological grounds, just profoundly unwise.
If it was modifying an embryo, which that means it's there in that person's DNA for their whole life, and it will be passed on to future generations who don't have the chance to consent to it. And of course, it would be most applicable to people with means and not people who don't have means. It just feels wrong. I am going to continue to resist any suggestion that that should be normalized.
Yeah, and I'm with you too. And I think that it's been quite well said that there's a difference between treating an individual, which is what, you know, trying to do gene therapy for an individual is, and treating the whole human race, which is what you're doing when you're affecting the germline. And that's not our calling. We're not here to treat the human race. Yes, we're called to treat individuals.
Right. And it is a form of eugenics, and it assumes that somebody decides what's an improvement. That has not got a good history in other circumstances for humanity. I don't know why it would have a good history now.
Yeah. One of the things that's also come up is you know, you make in the book a kind of strong defense of your kind of acceptance of the science of evolution and of, you know, the idea that there's no conflict between that and a kind of evangelical biblical faith, which, you know, me and Dad would strongly be in accord with you on that, as we've said on this podcast before. But one of the things that a lot of people come up with is the idea that actually evolution, for it to kind of work, it requires genetic mutations of the kind that you've spent your life kind of studying. That is how species develop and grow. And some of those are good adaptations that allow them to thrive, and some of them cause harm. How do you, as a Christian and a geneticist, square that circle? You know, Dad's talked before about a lot of his career was treating babies born with some quite severe abnormalities, physical handicaps, disabilities, because of, you know, tiny micro deletions in their DNA. And yet without those mutations, none of us would be here today.
It's a very important and difficult issue. I'm right there with you. I'm a medical geneticist, so much of my clinical activity has been in that same space of trying to make a precise diagnosis of somebody who has a misspelling somewhere in their genome that's caused significant consequences. And those can be truly heartbreaking when you see the effect on the individual and on their families of something like this happening, often unexpectedly out of the blue, and a great deal of grieving and suffering involved there. And I've counseled many families in that circumstance who are wrestling with, why did this happen, including Christian families? And there's no easy answer there. You can see families who've learned to live with a child who has a significant genetic disorder who will tell you this turned out to be a gift. This individual, although they will never end up being quite what we thought, has still been a source for us of joy and of opportunity to love unconditionally. I'm fond of the chapter in John chapter 9. It's sort of helpful in this regard. I don't know, John, whether this is one that you've also used. Remember, this is the one where the disciples are asking Jesus, why was that individual born blind? Was it, who sinned? Was it the parents or the child that made that happen? And Jesus says very clearly, neither. This happened so that the works of God might be manifest in him. Wow. I found that reassuring to some couples, realizing, oh, this special child, this is manifesting the works of God. And we have to figure out what that means. But it's still a heartbreak. And it's one of those many difficult questions about suffering or theodicy that I can never be quite confident I have an easy answer to, and I don't think we're supposed to. Tim Keller, near the end of his life, got asked this in a podcast. So, Tim, how do you deal with human suffering if you believe in a God who is loving and powerful? And the question was coming from an atheist. And Tim said, well, to be honest, I can take all of the arguments that have been made by theologians and believers over the course of the centuries, and I can take a bucket and I can pile those arguments in there, but I still only get about 2/3 full. And I kind of feel the same way. Yeah, people do learn from this. We don't learn necessarily when things are going great. We learn when things really aren't going great. Suffering is, as Lewis said, God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. In my own life, I've seen that. When my children have suffered, when my daughter was raped, it was horrible, awful, terrible experience. And yet it tested one's faith, and it tested her in a way that I think has led her to be a remarkable, compassionate, tender-hearted person for other women who have gone through terrible things. That doesn't justify it in any way, but it does say there is something there. And the other thing I can say is that as a Christian, I don't have to explain to God what suffering is about. That actually really means a lot to me, that Jesus suffering on the cross more than I could possibly imagine doesn't need me to say I'm hurting today. But I don't have a great answer. John, I'm curious how you've counseled couples in that circumstance where they're grieving for what feels like a lost dream.
Now, I resonate entirely with just what you said, Francis. And I think that one of the quotations which Tim has heard me say on many occasions, but I will say yet again, which meant a great deal to me, it's anonymous. It comes somewhere from the hospice movement here, but it said, suffering is not a question which demands an answer, and it's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence.
Oh, I love that.
So, and that's the calling. I mean, it's not to come up with slick answers. We haven't got any slick answers. There aren't any slick answers. Mm-hmm. It's not even a problem to soothe away, but it's a mystery. But we are called to be the presence. We're called to be the hands of Jesus without seeking to explain. We're there and we walk alongside and in a small way, I'm sure that's what both of us in our clinical practice have tried to do.
And I have to say, as a non-scientist, when I was reading in your book, Francis, some of your descriptions of the treatments that have come out of this revolution in genetics that you've been a part of, and, you know, I think it was for sickle cell anemia you were describing. There was some astonishing breakthroughs along with cystic fibrosis that came out of that work about identifying genes. Now, I was almost punching the air because, you know, for thousands of years, right, since human beings evolved, they've been having these random mutations that have caused devastating effects. And it is only in my lifetime, in the last 30 years, that we've been able to make any dent in that suffering, and that through the ingenuity and hard work of atheists and Christian scientists alike, but, you know, using the brains that God gave them, they are able to make incredible transformations to people's experience of these conditions. And I'm sure we'll see even more kind of advances to come. It does, you know, it's not an answer. It doesn't make up for the suffering, but there is something, there is real hope there, isn't there?
There is, absolutely. No, I'm glad you brought that up. And I think we are called as part of trying to model ourselves after Jesus. If we can be agents of healing, of alleviating suffering, that's one of the more noble things that we should strive for. And so that God has given us the chance to give people with sickle cell anemia, not just something that helps a little bit, but what looks like a cure, that is such a cause for celebration and a sense of answered prayer.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've running out of time, so we probably should draw. We could talk a long time, couldn't we? There's a lot more we could say, but we've got to let you get on to your next interview, Francis. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a real privilege and a delight to talk over these things with you and listen to your wisdom. So thank you for your time.
Well, I've loved talking to both of you, Tim and John. Thank you for what you're doing to spread the word here in matters of life and death. We've touched on a few of those.
One or two, yeah. That's the joy. You know, it covers pretty much everything. Matters of life and death and almost everything else in between. But yes, please do pick up a copy of Francis's book, The Road to Wisdom. If you can find it, I'm sure it's available and online and from all good bookshops. Yeah. We'll be back next week with another episode, but until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.